In this session, Michael Toms of New Dimensions Radio interviews James Redfield, author of the Celestine Prophecy book.
James, one of the aspects of this book is that a lot of the words of God, as they're portrayed here in conversations with God, are at odds with the religious doctrine and dogma of many of the religious institutions. What about that dichotomy?
Well, I think that it's really just indicative of where we are. I think that for so long, spiritual thought has been held in dogma. Maybe the culture could not hold it any other way. But I think at this point, we are shifting away from the dogma. The germ of truth is moving away from some of the older, more fundamental institutions of religion and into the great dialogue that we're having, the great conversation, in my view, where we're testing out for ourselves what to believe about spirituality, because we will find the evidence for it experientially. In the face of this grand conversation and the energy shifting over into the conversation, the religious institutions then have to evolve themselves and shift the dogma back toward the truth that I think is being defined popularly.
James, there's a quote in the book I want to recite here for you and get your comment on it. The deepest secret is that life is not a process of discovery, but a process of creation. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think there's a semantic problem right there. But essentially, I think what is being conveyed in the conversations with God is that this is nothing that we're to discover as though we did not already have it. In other words, living the spiritual life is really creating in the sense of engaging the experience. And I think in that sense, it's very, very true. I think that in another way, it feels like discovery. It feels like self-discovery. But I think we do have to keep in mind that it's that we're really not just discovering, we're remembering. We're trying to open up to that which we always have been.
Taking that a little further, one of the things that permeates conversations with God is the idea and the concept of we create our own reality. You create your own reality. What is your perspective? Do we create our own reality?
Well, I think that I really think what's being said here is that we all create the reality. And so while we personally are responsible for much of what happens to us personally, also what happens to us personally is a result of what everybody else is creating out there and all the interfaces that happen. And I definitely think that that's true. That's why to say that you're absolutely creating everything that happens to you is, to me, too strict. But to say that you are involved, you're co-creating everything that happens to you, I think is very close to the truth. But the main point in that, I think, is that it's not so much what happens to us as how we react to what happens to us, because that's that way we can make sure that if we react positively from a sense of love, then we are doing everything we can to keep our path on a positive track.
I think you brought out a salient point here, that it's not only we creating our own reality, but creating our own reality in the midst of many other realities being created by others. And this would explain or be a response to the critique that comes up about, well, did I create my cancer? Did I create my ill health? What about that? I mean, isn't that true?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we have to take responsibility for our part of it always. But I think we also live within a particular social reality that influences not only how we think, but influences the level of healthiness around us. So I think that our mission really is to not only to continue to project the positive personally, but also to be able to interact and hold on to this positive when we interact with others, because that helps them turn their creative energy around into the positive as well, which is another point I think you made very clearly in here, and that is the essence of relating is the act of forgiveness.
Another thing that's talked about a lot in the book is that we create the devil and we create hell and we also create heaven. What about that?
Well, I think that's, I would call that the tenth insight. We are to a place where we realize that the highest part of ourselves is that all-knowing God self that that truly evaluates how we're doing. We have to ultimately face how we've lived our lives, how we've created, how it has turned out. And if we feel disappointed in aspects of that life, it'll be us, it'll be ourselves that create that disappointment. If we are so cut off from the force of love that is who we are, that we're in total fear, it is hellish. And that's the definition of hell, is when we're so cut off that we are in that space instead of in a love space that has the connection with the divine.
At some point in the book, there wasn't a comparison or an equation of fear with hell, that when we're in fear, we're out of love, and that can be a hellish situation.
Absolutely. I just think that's a recognition that we're having out there. And I called it the tenth insight because I think that's the insight that's circulating through the culture right now. We know there's no other judgment that's going to happen to us about our lives other than the one that we impose and the greater part of us imposes. So I think there's a sense of awareness and imperative too, I think, that to go out and live our lives taking all the risks that we want, that we think we need to go for it all, to try to create at our highest level and take all the risks associated with that, because we know that we are going to feel responsible later on as to how well we've done it, and we're going to want to do it as well as we can.
James, one of the questions that came up for me was the reference to feelings as an indicator and a channel for truth. And I'm wondering, are we talking about levels of feelings? Because feelings have been the cause of wars and conflicts for millennia. And so what about that idea of feelings being a channel for the truth?
Well, I took that to mean that inwardly, once we get past the negative feelings that maybe distract us, that once we get clear that we have an inward feeling as to what is truth and what is not truth, and of course that's somewhat relative to our own situation, but each of us, I think, knows intuitively which move to make at any juncture in our lives. Now, we don't always do it because we rationalize it or we fall into fear about it and we can't really make the move, but at our highest level, if we can get to that, we know what to do and when to do it and what to say in every circumstance. We're guided. I mean, we have that higher self intuitive guidance at that level once we can find it within our own experience.
So in some sense, when you're talking about inward, you're really talking about going deeper to the deeper level of our feelings, right?
That's the way I would look at it, yes. There are all kinds of emotions that run through our experience. It can be jealousy and irritation and hatred and all the rest. But I think that those we know now are come from a place of fear and not a place of love. And if there's something we know, I think, here in the 90s, if we're really going to live our true spirituality, we have to stay in a space of love. First of all, we have to find that for ourselves and define it. And then we always have to come back to this space of love, this state of being that we know as love. You can abstractly debate philosophy and religion and dogma all you want to, but nothing matters except coming back to that state and that space of love. And I think that's one thing that has come into popular consciousness at this point.
So there's a quote in the book that follows up on what you just said. The highest thought is always that thought which contains joy. The clearest words are those words which contain truth. The grandest feeling is that feeling which you call love, joy, truth, and love. That's pretty much echoing what you just said.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that we really know now that there is an experience out there that's available to us. And we don't want to just talk about it. We don't want to think about it. We don't want to just debate about it. We want to go for it and experience that ourselves. And that's going to change everything because we are finally getting to a level of experience with all this. I always like to say that we've got a new image that's emerging out in the culture of what the good life is. The good life is to find that space of love, that space of joy, that space of euphoria almost. Because from that comes all the other things that we associate with fulfillment, like a sense of mission, a sense of making the world a better place, a sense of having good, positive relationships, knowing how to parent, all the rest. It all flows from staying in that space, and I think we know that now.
James, a lot of people are feeling pessimistic and cynical and not really hopeful or optimistic about the future. And one of the quotes in the book that I'd like you to comment on is, I tell you this, all you see in your world is the outcome of your idea about it. What is your comment on that statement?
Well, I think that's absolutely true and is so immense importance right now. The ideas we have about how we can turn the course of the world around, how we can make it more positive, how we can solve our social and environmental problems. The ideas that we project about that are going to create the state of the future. And, you know, I think that we've reached a point where we now know how powerful we are in terms of our ideas and our visualization of the future. And I think it's got to be that understanding that carries us through right now. We cannot just fall back into this fear reaction that the world is doomed and it can't be saved, because I really believe that all the heroes are in place, as I've said many times, that we can, all the people who need to intervene in all our social problems are already there. All we have to do is connect with this the divine guidance and the courage. Just everybody making a move at once can change the world literally overnight.
James, what was the most impressive aspect of conversations with God for you?
Well, I really liked the foundation it was built upon, the basic principles were voiced in the book. You know, a couple of sentences that I really loved had to do with heaven. And I think the answer that God gave was, there is no such thing as getting to heaven. There's only a knowing that you're already there. And, you know, the whole theme of remembering, I think is just so important for us at this time. It's something that, again, that I believe is emerging in the culture now, this awareness that, hey, we are spiritual beings. We always have been, and all we have to do is open up to it and remember it, and then our lives can change very, very dramatically.
So if you had something to share with people as to what they could do in these times, what would it be, James?
Well, I think what I like to say is that each of us has to find our own experience of the divine. You know, we have to have that experience whereby we become more than we were. We have a transcendent experience where our bodies feel different. We feel like a full or more complete person. We are imbued with a kind of energy that the mystics have always talked about. As being transforming. And people find that in different ways. They find it in the churches and synagogues, in prayer. They find it in meditation. But we also find it in dance and in body work the martial arts, and we find it in visiting sacred sites on this planet. You know, there's an inspiring energy that certain locations can give us. And I think I would say that the first chore in the 90s is to go out and find that transcendent experience, because everything else springs from that sense of being part of the divine and having the source within that the mystics have always talked about.
James, thank you for being with us today. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Michael.
Michael Pond now interviews Shakti Gawain, author of Creative Visualization.
Hi, Shakti.
Hi.
So, you've read Conversations with God. This is a book similar to other books that have appeared. I mean, it's not the same thing, obviously, but there's a lot of books that have been published in recent years. I think of the Celestine Prophecy, Ancient Message, books like Care of the Soul and others that deal with spirituality and enriching our spiritual life. Why do you think that's all that's happening right now? Because it seems like they're coming in abundance.
Oh, gosh. I mean, to me, it's been happening for quite some time. So, you know, I've been pretty tuned in to the kinds of ideas and books that have been coming out for about 25 years now. So I guess it's true that it's reaching more and more people and reaching into the mainstream and reaching the masses much more. I think that's just because the evolution of consciousness is getting to the point where it's really more and more people are finding the necessity to tune into these kinds of ideas.
Do you have conversations with God, Chuck?
Well, I don't think of it that way because I wasn't brought up in any kind of Christian or even any kind of organized religion at all, although my family did have some religious roots. But I don't relate that much to the word God or the image of God as a person, as a man, or whatever. So I don't think of it that way. But using other terms, yes, I do very much. And an awful lot of my own personal work and my own teaching has been about that precise thing, that we each have that connection inside of us to that higher intelligence and wisdom, and that we can access that within ourselves. So, yes, I do. I do that on a regular basis and have for many years.
In the book, there's a lot of emphasis on paying attention to your feelings and going inside. And how do you see that from your own work with visualization and intuition? And how would you compare what you do with what God is saying here in this book?
Well, this particular God, the way he is expressing, is coming through with a pretty strong Christian orientation. I mean, counteracting a lot of the misunderstandings and limitations in the way that people commonly practice and understand Christianity, and I think in a very wonderful way, actually, explaining what the real meaning of a lot of that is. There's an emphasis, to me, there's quite an emphasis on thoughts, how thoughts create our reality. And that's something that, of course, I explored a lot in my early books, Creative Visualization, Living in the Light, and it's been a foundation of my work. In recent years, I've moved a lot more into exploring what I call all four levels of our being, spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical. And I think there's a lot of necessity and a lot of importance to deal with the emotional level as well as the mental level. And in this book, there's a kind of more of an emphasis on the mental. As I find in most kind of traditional spiritual books, it talks a lot more about the spiritual and the mental. And yes, it does make reference in passing kind of to our emotions and how important they are and how we need to accept them. But it doesn't really tell very much about how do we really do that. And what I find is that's the stumbling block for most people, is the level of deep emotional healing. We don't know much about how to do that. We don't have very many role models. So my work has probably more emphasis on doing the emotional healing and really bringing it into the physical. But I have to say that one of the reasons I like this book is because most of what's being said in this book is almost word for word, concept for concept, things I've said in my own book, from creative visualization through living in the light to path of transformation.
So you believe that thought, you think thought basically determines our reality, what we think and how we perceive?
I think that certainly what we think and how we perceive is a large part of what creates our experience of reality. I think what we feel, our emotions and our emotional patterns are a big part of that too, and they're different from our thoughts. And most people don't differentiate that. Most people just talk about thoughts and how our thoughts create a reality and talk about how we have to change our thoughts. But I don't find that most people in the spiritual traditions talk much about the deep emotions and feelings and emotional patterns we have. And it's a very different thing to deal with those. You have to deal with them in a different way. You can't just change your emotions. You have to really experience and embrace your emotions. And when you think about it, emotions happen to us a lot earlier in life than thoughts do. And we feel for months at least, if not years, before we begin to form those feelings into thoughts. So it's in some ways a deeper level, I feel. But yes, we do. And our thoughts have a lot to do with creating our reality.
You've also, your work has taken you into relationships. You've written
mm-hmm.
that relationship.
And, yeah.
And there's a quote in the book that I'd like to bring out right now. Relationships are sacred because they provide life's grandest opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, it's only opportunity to create and produce the experience of your highest conceptualization of self.
Absolutely.
You agree with that?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I do workshops all the time about how relationships is our best path of consciousness. It's our most relentless reflection. We can count on our intimate relationships to always be reflecting to us what our growth is, what our next level of healing and learning and growing is. And I do believe that the purpose of relationship is to help us develop our greatest potential. And they're very effective at that if we know how to use them. Most of us don't really know how to use them that way. So I appreciated what he had to say about relationship.
There's a large focus in this book on love and
mm-hmm.
love being the path.
Yeah, and as I read through the book, there were very few things I disagreed with. In fact, most of the things I went, yeah, that's what I say too. There were a couple of places. One of the things I felt a little uncomfortable with is, see, I really believe that this is a plane of duality, of polarities, in which our task is to learn to truly honor and embrace all opposites, all polarities, that one isn't better than another, but that, in fact, all the aspects of life are equally valuable and blessed. And he says that over and over again here, but then sometimes when he gives examples, it seems to have a different emphasis, like he's saying everything is either love or fear. And it's quite clear from the way he talks about that love is better, you know. Yes, we need to, you know, accept fear and so forth, but what we really want to do is get to love. And to me, that still has that same underlying implication of one's higher, one's lower, one's better, one's worse, one's good, one's bad. It felt that way as I was reading it. And see, to me, fear is a way we characterize the emotional state of contraction. Love is the emotional state of expansion. We need both expansion and contraction in the physical world. If we just expanded all the time, you know, there would be no boundaries. There would be no individuation. One isn't better than the other.
But somehow, perhaps you have to experience fear, just like you have to experience suffering, in order to understand the deep dimensions of life and to understand love. You have
well,
to
and there's
fear.
A purpose for fear in the physical world. I mean, we feel fear, valid fear, when there's danger, when we need to protect ourselves, when we need to pull back physically from something that's dangerous to us or emotionally. So I just, that was the only thing that I, you know, or one of the only things that I kind of reacted to. And there aren't very many other people I ever hear saying what I'm saying. You know, I mostly hear people saying this, but let's choose love, let's let go of fear, let's get rid of fear and choose love because love is the higher. And I know what they mean. I mean, it feels much better to love than to fear. Yet there, I don't know, I just think that there's a place for both and they're both appropriate. You know, my way of thinking of it is that on a spiritual level, love is what we are. Unconditional love is our experience on a spiritual level. And whenever we get the opportunity to touch into that level, we get that wonderful feeling of unconditional love. On a human level, unconditional love, it's not human. You know, on a human level, we have needs, we have vulnerabilities, we have to protect ourselves. We love and we need both. To have unconditional love, you have to have no needs. And on a human level, we do have needs. And I think being here, one of the reasons we've chosen to come here is to explore this dimension of humanness, of vulnerability, of having needs, of having emotions, of not being so perfect and so self-sufficient. Am I making sense?
Yes, uh-huh.
So, I don't know, I'm just kind of a champion for not in any way implying that the human aspect is less than the spiritual. But really, they're both incredibly beautiful, and we're here, I think, at this point in our evolution to try to bring them together and have this experience in physical bodies on the earth of being human and being divine.
How do you pray?
Well, I don't usually think of it as praying, again, because I don't come from that kind of orientation and that word was not something that I ever really related to. I think of it, but there's nothing wrong with it. It's just not a word that I particularly relate to. I meditate, and for me, meditation is really just sitting quietly and being with myself, with whatever's happening. If I happen to be in my mind with a lot of thoughts going on, just sort of allowing myself to be with that. And as I do that, often that starts to quiet down a little bit, and maybe I move into what I'm feeling emotionally, just becoming aware of that. And oftentimes then I can kind of drop down into what feels like a deeper place, a more core place, a more essence place, and just making contact with my own essence, which is also connected to the essence of life and God and, you know, greater intelligence, whatever you want to call it. And then I often just, I just open to receiving if there's any reminder or message or something that I need to be aware of. Or if I have a question or a problem, I'll ask, you know, what do I need to know about this? Or what do I need to heal in this situation? And just pose the question, and if some kind of answer or insight comes to me, I take it. And oftentimes it doesn't right at that moment, but I know that by posing the question and asking for what I need, I'm creating a space for it to come to me either internally or oftentimes externally. So it's kind of a communion with that deeper wisdom that I feel is inside of me and in all of us.
There's something in the book that deals with prayer about that prayer really is something, not prayer that don't come in supplication, but come already in gratitude for what you already have.
Yeah, I think that's pretty powerful. I mean, I can come in any way that you want to.
Yeah.
You know, come however you feel to. Sometimes you feel like, I need help, you know, or please. But that is kind of a disempowered place, and I think it's okay to be that way sometimes. It's like the universe can be our mother and father if that's what we need. But I agree that real powerful change and transformation comes from allowing yourself to really experience it the way you want it to be. And that's what my book, Creative Visualization, is really all about. And experiencing it with gratitude and appreciation. Yeah. If you can muster that up, that's a good thing to do.
In conversations with God, did you resonate with the voice of God here? Did you resonate with it? Sounds like you did. Sounds like you resonated a lot with it.
Yeah, I did. I mean, as I said, I feel like a lot of what was being said in maybe slightly different words are things that I find myself saying or that I've written a lot.
Also, another part of the conversation with God is just the emphasis on living without expectation. Acting without thought of the results. I mean, not that we think of the results at some point before we act, but that we're moving through life really coming from the deepest part of ourselves, from our passion, and we're expressing our beingness through that.
Well, I love the passion part, and I do feel that the more you live your passion and follow your desires and honor your feelings and express who you are, the more clear you become. I get a little anxious about See, again, it's a kind of a very traditional spiritual approach to say, you know, we need to live without expectation. That's wonderful. That's like being unconditionally loving and non-judgmental. It's all a kind of a wonderful spiritual ideal. Everybody I know has a real hard time doing that, including myself.
Yeah.
And those kinds of, I mean, trying to live up to a spiritual ideal so often causes such a split in people. It puts us in conflict with ourselves. God, I want to be unconditionally loving and non-judgmental, but really, I feel that I'm, you know, conditionally loving and judgmental a lot. What's wrong with me? Why can't I give this up? Why can't I be more like that? And there we are, judging ourselves, feeling bad about ourselves, feeling in conflict, which is the opposite of the way, you know, what the teaching is supposed to help us with. So my feeling is that, again, everything, all polarities are true. It's wonderful to have times where we can let go of expectations. It really is an incredible freedom when we can do it. It's wonderful to have those moments of unconditional love. It's wonderful to have those times of non-judgment. It's great to be looking at our judgments and see, where do they come from? Why do I have this? Can I let go? What's underneath it, you know? But also to really love ourselves on the human side for the fact that we do have expectations. We do have judgments. It's all part of the human experience. And I think we can learn to work with them. I mean, ultimately, what he's saying is true. You can learn to work with them and work through them and let go more and more. But I don't know if it's a good idea to be trying to live up to that ideal, because that takes us out of our real experience.
Well, at times it just reminds me, during the book, Conversation with God, that sometimes the author apologizes or says, oh, you know,
yeah.
And God says, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Forgive yourself. It's okay.
Uh-huh.
Move on. And so there's this
mm-hmm.
constant theme that comes through, forgiving yourself.
Yeah.
We need to forgive ourselves more often.
Absolutely. But, you know, it's hard to forgive yourself when you've got a spiritual ideal that says, you really. See, I do hear a little bit of this message in this book, and it's the only part that I don't really resonate with. And it's the part that I don't resonate with in most traditional spiritual writings or teachings from either the Eastern or the Western or the New Age tradition, where it's like it's all being said, yes, we must accept all of it and it's all wonderful, but at the same time there seems to be this double message that's saying it's all wonderful but this is better.
Mm-hmm.
If only we could be, you know, self-sufficient and non-judgmental and not have expectations, then that would be even better, you know. And that makes it hard to really accept fully what the human experience is.
There's another aspect that comes up in what you're saying, and that is that in conversation with God, God does say that, and kind of repeating what Jesus said in the Gospel of Thomas,
mm-hmm.
Which is one of the later scriptures they found in the Nag Hammadi scriptures, where the kingdom, where is the kingdom, Lord? And he says, the kingdom is before you. It's right here before
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
And God in this conversation also says that that's true.
Yes. It's become quite clear to me in my own life experience that heaven and hell are definitely right here all the time. I mean, I experience myself sometimes as being in hell, you know, when I just feel miserable and I feel blocked and I'm in confusion and life just feels terrible. And I know at those moments, oh, this is what hell is all about. This is where the concept of hell came from. We create it. We experience it right here, right now, at certain times and in certain ways. And similarly, I have moments of feeling incredible bliss and everything's perfect and it's all this wonderful flow and it's just heaven. So, yeah, it seems very clear to me that those are both aspects of our experience.
Jackie, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And now, here's Michael Toms of New Dimensions Radio interviewing Neil Donald Walsh.
Neil, how has your life changed since writing the book Conversations with God, An Uncommon Dialogue?
Gosh, I think everything about my life is different. I have a relationship now that works, and works wonderfully. I have all the money anyone could ever ask for, frankly, to be honest. I have great health. I'm in far better health than ever I was before. But I think the most important thing, because those are all exterior, is that it feels very much as if the interior part of me is finally coming together, is finally being repaired, is finally, I hate to use the overworked word, but is finally being healed. I feel more one. I feel more one with myself, and I feel more at one-ment with everyone else and everything. It's a healing of the deepest part of me that I've waited for a long time. And that's, I think, the largest difference that I notice as a result of this book.
Do you have a spiritual practice now, a regular discipline that you follow?
Well, I'm not a very disciplined person. You know, when I was 27, they put a sign on the door outside my office, "Don't try to discipline this guy, just tap his genius." I used to laugh at that, but they never took it off the door. I worked at that place for 10 years. I think that they saw something in me that they made fun of, but that was really true, which was that I had... How do I say this without sounding arrogant? I had a level of awareness and creativity that might have been, by some people's measurement, at a genius level. I think many people do, for that matter. But I absolutely had no sense of discipline, nor do I hope I ever have any. That's probably not politically correct to say that. But if I had a bumper sticker I could create, it would be "Down with Discipline." And so I don't discipline myself. My spiritual practice in my everyday life is what it is when it is that, and it's not that when it's not. So I meditate except on days that I don't. And I move through certain physical exercises except on days when I don't. And I read a great many spiritual books except when I don't. And so I allow myself really to flow freely through my experience of self, and through my experience of all the rest of this wonderful adventure that we are mutually embarked upon. And I don't really get too rigid with myself. I don't have schedules. I don't have a diet that I really stick to religiously, to use a probably bad word, but although I am careful with what I eat in some ways. But so I'm not a terribly disciplined guy. I think there are probably about two disciplines that I do adhere to. I don't drink any alcohol, and I don't smoke. And I haven't for years, and those are about the only disciplines I can think of, really, in my life.
Neil, have you always been interested in spiritual things?
Yes, I have. I have from the earliest days of my life. When I was 7 and 8 years old, I was asking my parents questions that they couldn't answer. They sent me to parochial school. I was educated in a Roman Catholic school. And I would ask the nuns and the priests who would come in. Once a week, the priests would come in and teach catechism. And I would ask the priests and the pastor of the parish the questions that he couldn't answer. And when I was 9 or 10 or 11, those pastors began saying to me, "Why don't you come out over to the rectory? We can talk about this some more." And they would actually invite me into their study. And I would talk theology with the priests when I was 10 and 11 years old. Now, obviously, it wasn't high theology, but it was high theology for an 11-year-old, without a doubt. And I asked all kinds of questions that provoked interesting conversations, like, how do we know truly? What is right and wrong?
You were raised Roman Catholic and eventually left the church. Why did you leave?
Well, of course, it wasn't a decision that one makes overnight or in a split second. It was a cumulative thing. It was a cumulative thing that happened over a period of years. My movement away from the church. But I think what really broke it for me was in my early 20s, I was about 23 or 24, somewhere in there, I picked up a newspaper and I realized that something astonishing had happened. The Roman Catholic Church had announced that eating meat on Fridays was no longer a sin. Now, you might say, well, what's the problem? Except that through all of my young years, when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, I had been a very devout young Catholic boy, and I was very, very serious about following all the rules, including never sinning. And one of the things I didn't do for all the years of my youth was I never ate meat on Fridays. And there were many times when I had to miss a lot of joy and fun because I couldn't eat meat on Fridays, and everyone else around me was going to the ballpark, for instance, and having a hot dog or whatever. And that's not a big deal, you know, in life, naturally. But in my life it was, and what I noticed was that what this brought up for me was, oh, I get it, right and wrong are a movable feast. Right and wrong, even the Roman Catholic Church changes its mind about what is or is not a sin. Well, if I thought that the Roman Catholic Church was going to change its mind from time to time about what was a sin and what was not a sin, what was right and wrong, I thought I'd better get out of that church. That church was a little bit too flexible for me, and that was said about all of religion.
After you disconnected from the Catholic Church, did you pursue other religions?
Yes, also having to do with the Roman Catholic Church. I was kicked out of the altar boys. I was a very devout young Catholic boy, and I had intended to become a priest. And at the age of 12, I was surreptitiously removed, unceremoniously dumped from the local altar boy contingent at my parish. And the reason that I was fired, if you will, from the altar boys is that I arrived for a procession. We had a processional that all the altar boys were going to be in, carrying candles and the crucifix and so forth. And I was about 3 minutes late for that. Not too late to get into the procession, mind you, but too late for the Mother Superior, who was nominally in charge of organizing the altar boys. And because I came into the sanctuary a bit late to get on my chasuble and my robes, she said, you're no longer part of us. Well, you might think that's a petty little childhood event, but in fact, I couldn't imagine, because everyone, I think, had observed a great sense of devotion in me. And in that Catholic church, I was known as the one who had the calling. And they thought that I was going to become the next priest to emerge from that parish. Not taken lightly, I might add, in Catholic neighborhoods. And so for me to be dumped that way from the altar boys said more things to me about the nature of human churches and humanly constructed religions and our true relationship with God. Because I didn't feel any separation from God at all because I had been 3 minutes late. And I was literally 3 minutes late. But I did feel a great separation from my local parish church. And that really turned me away from Roman Catholicism, which was, I'm sure, an enormous turning point in my life. And having said that, I should add that I honor the Roman Catholic Church greatly, and I'm very grateful to it because it brought me my earliest sense of the presence of something larger than myself in the universe. And it also taught me that honoring that larger part of the universe that existed outside of myself was not a bad thing to do. When I was 17 and 18 and emerging from high school and getting into college, I began looking once again at the question of religion and theology. And I moved into the Presbyterian Church and thought I would find a home there. And I did for a bit, and I was even asked by the congregation where I attended if they could send me to the seminary. And I would come back as an associate minister at that church for a number of years to pay back the loan. They were actually going to give me money to go because they saw, again, something inside of me. I'm not sure what it was, but it's been identified by a lot of people through the years that might be useful in such an occupation as the ministry. But the more I delved into the theological constructions of mainstream Protestantism, the more I began to realize that there, too, I could not be comfortable and could not find a home. And that really launched a 25-year investigation of virtually every spiritual tradition on the face of the earth of which I am currently aware. And I looked really at them all, some more than others, but at least touching bases with all of them. I read a great deal of comparative theology. I spent days and weeks and months in the libraries around the country where I began moving because of my career. And I looked very deeply. I even had long conversations. I would sit down with rabbis, and I sat down once for 2 days for a weekend with a man from the Middle East, and he explained a great many of the Middle Eastern Orthodox theologies. And so I began to get my mind deeply involved in the question of how human beings experience the gods, the various gods of their understandings. And if any one of those ways would be comfortable for me, and I have to say that I could find a complete comfort in none of those constructions.
Where were you in your life when you began writing Conversations with God? Were you at a low point? Can you go back and recreate that time for me?
Well, I was in a very bad place, Michael. I was noticing that nothing really in my life was working. I was in a relationship that was very unrewarding, and I must say, through no fault of the marvelous lady who was sharing my life and in partnership with me at that time. I simply didn't know and hadn't learned through all the years of my life how to make relationship work, even with a person as wonderful as she. And that was depressing to me because I thought, gosh, if I can't make a relationship work with someone as really wonderful as this person, then with whom can I make relationship work? And likewise, my career was in a shambles. I was working all right. I wasn't out of work. But the work that I was doing had become, after 30 years, terribly unrewarding and not at all a producing of happiness or joy or a feeling of fulfillment. Indeed, I used to think, am I going to be doing this when I'm 65? Am I going to actually retire out of this particular profession? And it did not seem to be the way that I always thought I would touch the world, nor the way that I thought that, for that matter, the world would touch me with its magnificence. I wasn't feeling that through my work. And my health, not surprisingly because of all the rest of this, was also rapidly going downhill, with ailments large and small, seemingly assaulting my body, which was just about reaching the age of a half century. And so as I would wake up in the morning during those days and times, I recall feeling desperately unhappy and enormously frustrated because I didn't know how to deal with my unhappiness. I didn't know how to produce the kind of experience of life of which I knew that human beings were capable, but which I had not been able to produce in all the many years that I had been around here. And so it was out of that sense of desperation, and it was a months-long kind of depression. And I have to tell you, Michael, that I'm not a kind of a person who's in his lifetime been chronically depressed. In fact, I've never had that experience before. But if someone were to search for a clinical definition of where I was during that period, I'm sure they would say that I was, in fact, chronically depressed. That is to say, over a period of 8, 10, or 12 weeks, for 3 months or longer, I was just simply down in the dumps. And more than down in the dumps, I was beginning to question the very reason and purpose for my existence and, to be quite frank, whether I even wanted to go on. Because, to borrow the words of that wonderfully poignant song by Peggy Lee, I was asking myself, is that all there is? Is this really all there is? Because if it is, somebody send in the clowns. And it was out of that place of deep, deep desperation and enormous frustration that I awoke one night, unable to sleep, tossing and turning, and it was around 4:20 in the morning, and so I got out of bed and, so as not to disturb the lady that I was partnering in life with and the rest of the household, and went someplace where I could be by myself. I didn't even know frankly what I was doing or why I was up or what I was going to do. I searched around and rummaged through the refrigerator thinking my old friend food would solve the problem, but there was nothing in there I wanted, and so I went to the living room, sat on the couch, and looked at the four walls with one tiny lamp on. It's 4:20 in the morning. But I saw, luckily for me, that there was, for one reason or another, a pad of paper, a yellow legal pad, and a pencil on the lower shelf of the coffee table. And I reached down, I picked it up, and I began to write. I simply wrote therapeutically to no one in particular, just an angry letter to the universe, if you will, to the great unseen. And the letter contained desperate statements and angry statements. Why, I can't even repeat some of them here in this interview, but why is life being this way? What does it take for relationships to work? Why can't I do what I love to do, truly love to do, and make a living? When is it my turn? When will life show up for me in the way I had been promised from the earliest days of my youth? And how come I can't have what I see so many other people having? Fulfillment and a sense of completion with some of the earlier mysteries of life, a sense of inner peace, and joie de vivre, joy in life. What does it take? And I wrote all these questions out in a very angry, angry letter to no one in particular. And when I was finished writing those questions, and I must have been at that legal pad for 20 minutes or more, finally I had written myself out, you know, and my hand was becoming tired just from the writing of it, so I put it down and I reached over to the side of me to put the pen down on the side table, and the pen literally would not leave my hands. And my hand was drawn back to the legal pad. I picked it back up, and I thought, I guess there's something more I want to write here. And I frankly didn't even know what I was going to write next.
But as the pad hit the paper, words came to me silently in my head from what I could only describe as a voiceless voice. And the voiceless voice said to me, and I quickly wrote the thought, "Do you really want answers to all of these questions, or are you just venting?" And I laughed, and I chuckled, and I said to myself, "This is interesting. Where did that thought come from?" But I decided to play a game with myself. I thought, okay, I'm talking to myself in my mind. That's all right. That's part of the therapy, I guess. And so I wrote an answer. Yeah, I'm venting, but I would like answers too. And if you've got answers to all these questions, don't hold them back. I sure as hell like to hear them. And with that, this voiceless voice again began speaking, if you will, in almost as if someone were whispering in my right ear. And I began writing as quickly as I could what I was hearing in my head. It was very much like taking dictation. And there followed the most extraordinary exchange that went on periodically over the next year, with my writing back, if you will, answering his questions or asking her questions that came to me, and receiving answers almost immediately, so quickly that I almost couldn't write fast enough to keep up. And several times during the dialogue, I had to say, whoa, slow down, give me a chance here. And the voice did slow down. A very considerate person. So I was engaged in that process for over a year. But that particular morning when it began, I recall vividly, because I stopped writing after about an hour and a half of this back-and-forth dialogue, the beginnings of which formed the very beginning of the book Conversations with God. And when I finished, I turned back the pages to see what I had written. I had not done that at any point during the dialogue, but finally when I realized I was talked out, if you will, for the morning, I turned back the pages and I began reading. And frankly, Michael, I was stunned with what I found there on my own legal pad in my own handwriting. And I didn't know where this was coming from. Partly I felt very, very much afraid. Partly I felt almost overjoyed. And I didn't even know why I was feeling joy. I just felt very joyful, the experience. And so it was a mixture of fear and joy, or fear and love, if you will, not unlike life itself.
That's quite an account you just gave, Neil. It sounds like what was happening is that you were outside of your thinking mind. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, that's exactly how it was, Michael. I wasn't thinking at all. And it is said in the book, in order to really get in touch with God, you have to be out of your mind. And I think that I was out of my mind that morning. Many people think that I am out of my mind in general, and that may also be true. But I do think, in the literal sense, I was existing at that point outside of my mind. That is to say, I wasn't thinking at all about what was being said here in and through me. Nor was I thinking about what I was going to say in return. It was a very much a spontaneous conversation, as the one we're having right now, where I have no idea what you're going to say next, and you have no idea what I'm going to say next. And that's exactly how I experienced it, except that the voice was coming at me from just outside and above my right ear, and then I would hear it, and I'd begin to write. It was, often at the beginning of paragraphs, I would have no idea where the end of that paragraph was going. That was particularly true in the section on the Ten Commandments, one of the most extraordinary sections in the book, when I had no idea. I recall vividly when the voice said to me, "This may upset a lot of people, but I have to begin this part of our dialogue by telling you there's no such thing as the Ten Commandments." And I recall writing back, sitting up straight on the couch that particular morning, writing back, there are no Ten Commandments? And the answer came back, no. And I had no idea what that was about. I had no idea, well, now where do we go with this? And so all I did was just sit there in the darkness and listen and take dictation. And out came one of the most extraordinary constructions, one of the most extraordinary theological constructions around our concept of the Ten Commandments I've ever encountered. Quite apart and aside from the fact that particular construction stepped outside of any paradigm I've ever held, it was in and of itself a unique description of our true and right relationship with God, in my opinion. And it was at that point in the book that I realized, at that point in the dialogue, that I realized that I was, in fact, communicating with something much larger than myself, something that existed quite apart and separate from me,
something with which I have nothing to do. I even gave up my thought, well, I'm imagining this, or I'm calling this forth from my own higher self, or all of those other ways I was trying to explain what was happening. And it was after that section on the Ten Commitments that I realized, no, this is something very separate from me. And yet, of course, when the book was finished, I realized that separate from me does not exist in the experience of God. But I used the popular vernacular in that I understood it was not coming from any of my own prior experiences or my own previous thoughts about this thing called God.
I'd like to talk about some of the things that are in the book and how the book is presented. One of the aspects I noticed is that the book seems to have a largely Christian orientation, though there was cursory mention of other spiritual traditions. What about that largely Christian orientation, Neil?
Well, I don't experience it as having a largely Christian orientation. In fact, I think, as a matter of fact, I think that the people who would argue the most that it has anything but a Christian orientation would be devout Christians, and certainly born-again Christians and fundamentalists would be the first to disagree with you. They would almost scoff at anyone's description of this book as having a largely Christian orientation. In fact, some have said that the book was written by just the opposite, by the Antichrist. So I find your observation to be somewhat unique among the reactions that I received to the book. Although it is true that the great teacher Jesus has been mentioned a number of times in the book, I suspect that that had to do with the fact that God speaks to each of us along the avenues and through the channels with which she knows we are deeply familiar. And because my own particular upbringing and background happened to be in the largest of the Christian sects, the Roman Catholic Church, I believe that it was not inappropriate nor terribly unexpected that God would use the teacher with whom I was most familiar to make some very important points. In that context, I understand your question. God has said to us in the book that he will use any device, any tool, any channel, the lyrics of the next song you hear, the storyline of the next movie you watch, or the words of any teacher with which you are deeply familiar and to which you are emotionally attached. And I think, therefore, that we can expect God to show up in our lives and to communicate with us in our lives through the mediums with which we are most personally familiar. Therefore, it is not at all shocking to me that the revelations, and I use that word advisedly, received by peoples elsewhere in the world differ in tone, but rarely in content, from the revelations in conversations with God, and that difference of tone or nuance has to do with the adjustments that God has made, if you will, to the awarenesses and the consciousness of the messenger. And so God will speak to someone in the Middle East, I'm certain, with constructions and nuances that are largely Middle Eastern in their theological approach.
Speaking of God using anything and everything to communicate with us, in the book it says that feelings are a channel for the truth. Feelings are the language of the soul. Feelings can run the gamut from anger to love and have been the cause of many wars and conflicts over the centuries, even to this day and time. How do you reconcile this apparent dichotomy of feelings and truth?
The statement actually is feelings are the language of the soul. Now we'll get back into my own theological constructions here. I do use the figure of Jesus as a point of reference because he is the master teacher, one of many, with whom I am most familiar. And so in response to your question, I'll begin by saying even Jesus experienced anger. And the story of his driving the money changers out of the temple was not placed in the Bible without awareness on the part of those who were constructing that scriptural collection. They were deeply aware that in order for us to truly understand spiritual truth, in order for us to deeply understand spiritual truth, we needed to be given a model and an example of a person who allowed himself to genuinely experience all the feelings that he was feeling. The question, therefore, before human race is not whether we ought to allow ourselves or to look inside of ourselves for the truth of our feelings, but how we ought to express those feelings in a way that allows us to elevate our experience of who and what we are. Anger in itself is not a negative emotion. Anger is simply a gift from God, a way that we have of saying, no thank you,
a way that we have of causing others to notice that something or another is not okay with us. It is rarely an emotion, or I should say rarely a feeling, that is inappropriate. Feelings are, by definition, never inappropriate because, in fact, it's how we feel. And we get into more trouble by trying to deny that we feel a certain way in order to come off within our own constructions as holy or as healed or as altogether. And this sublimation of our feelings, this repression, is what creates a great deal of the psychological difficulties confronting humankind. Therefore, I think it's the free expression and the free flow of our deepest feelings which produces the greatest freedom. Now, the question, therefore, is not ought we to express our feelings freely, or not even, the question isn't even, is it good or is it okay to have a negative feeling, like anger or even hatred or envy or jealousy or rage. Those issues are not the real issues. The issue is when we feel rage, when we feel anger, when we feel any negative emotion, what do we do in response to that? What is the way we deal with that? And what action do we allow ourselves and permit ourselves to take as a result of that? And it is in the answer to that question that mastery is found, not in the sublimation of the feeling itself. If you want to know what's true for you, just listen to your feelings.
When I hear you say listen to your feelings, I hear you talking about listening deeply, not in a shallow way.
Well, actually, I'm talking about both, Michael. I think first we have to listen in a shallow way to what's coming up for us in the instant moment. And then after we hear what's really true for us in the instant moment about a thing, then if we have the willingness and the desire and the level of mastery, I want to say, that allows us to go deeper, then we look even more deeply into that first flush of feeling to see what feeling is behind the feeling, if you will, and more deeply and more deeply and more deeply, like layers of, you know, of onion skin from the onion, until we peel away all but the deepest feeling and the purest thought. So, but I don't think it starts there. I mean, I think you have to begin to look at the most shallow feelings and look at them, frankly, in a rather superficial way, as in simply, hey, I'm angry here, or that really upsets me, or I'm jealous. I'm just simply jealous. I don't want you going out until 10 o'clock with that other guy, or whatever it is that's coming up for you, just to be able to notice it, to hold it, to speak it, to be safe with it, to feel okay with it, to stop condemning ourselves about even our most shallow interpretation of our feelings. Because it is after we get through the shallow water that we can submerge ourselves in the deep. One doesn't dive to the bottom without going through the top.
Another aspect in the book is that love and fear seem to be in opposition. Can you explain that further?
In truth, love and fear are not in opposition, and the book makes very clear that there is only one thing, and that's love, and that love is all there is. And the book makes that statement repeatedly so that we might understand what is really so. Nevertheless, within the context of love being all there is, we see that there can be polarities. Let me relate this to the color white. White is not the absence of every other color, but rather it is the inclusion of all colors. And every other color in the universe put together and mixed in together produces white. That's also true with love. Love is not the absence of anger. It's not the absence of negative emotion, but in fact the inclusion of every single kind of emotion that there is. All of it put together is the thing we call love, which word we use interchangeably, some of us, with the word God. And that God is love and love is God, and those two words are interchangeable. Now, having announced and proclaimed that in highest truth, love is all there is, or, if you will, God is all there is, God then described to us the relative universe, and in the book, Conversations with God, this is described in some considerable, and I want to say elegant, detail, describing the relative universe where we established two polarities, if you will, and a system of duality that includes left and right, now and then, before and after, male and female, up and down, fast and slow, good and evil, and love and fear. And that the two ends of these of this duality, love on one side and fear on the other, are really, if you can see it in your mind's eye, the two sides of a circle.
That is to say, love is at, let's say, nominally 9 o'clock, and fear is at 3 o'clock. Most people start off at noon and get down to 3 and have to go through fear to get to love. It's quite interesting. But if you hold the picture of a circle in your mind's eye or the face of a clock, you will see that love is on one side in my construction and fear is at the other, but they're all the same thing. See, they're all the same circle. And yet, without love being on one side and fear being on the other, or what we call love and call fear in the relative experience known as the human adventure of life, without our definition of those two sides of the circle itself cannot exist. And the book explains rather in great detail how this system of relativity works and how in the world of duality, a thing cannot exist without its direct opposite. Therefore, up is just a concept and not a reality without down. Fast is merely a concept having no reality in time and space without slow. And similarly, all parts of the duality, including love and fear. And therefore, in order for love to exist as an experienceable, there's a coin a word, as an experienceable energy in the universe, love, there must be that thing in our system of duality that we call fear. In the absence of what you are not, that which you are cannot be. I'll say that again. In the absence of that which you are not, that which you are cannot be. That is to say, in the absence of up, you cannot be down. In the absence of cold, you cannot be hot. In the absence of evil, you cannot be the thing called good. Not in this relative universe. In the realm of the absolute, where God resides, of course, one can be all those things, and one is all those things simultaneously. But in order for us to experience, in order for us to know experientially these concepts, which is, of course, the purpose of the human soul, we needed to create, and God needed to create, I use the word we and God interchangeably here, a system of duality and a system of polarities. Therefore, love and fear exist as two sides of the same circle, and yet it's all the same stuff. Some people choose to picture love and fear as two ends of a long rod or a long straight line, with love on one side and fear on the other, and in this way, in their mind, they construct a mental image, if you will, of the great polarity. That isn't the image of the great polarity at all. The image is the one I gave you, a circle with love at 9 o'clock and fear at 3. And as soon as you bend that rod around and connect it to itself, you see the beautiful symmetry and the awesome simplicity of the design.
Conversations with God takes the form of book 1, 2, and 3. Is this all God has to say, or will there be more volumes?
I really don't know, Michael. This is a risky thing to say. Part of me hopes that it ends with book 3, because people are beginning to look at me as some kind of source for enormous truth and for deep insight and instant understanding of the most profound concepts with which the human race has confronted itself. And that is not a place with which I am most comfortable. And so it's become a very interesting experience for me in my life. And if the dialogue were over and with the end of book 3, it would not displease me, and I would have an opportunity to remove myself from that position as the current messenger of the moment. God help me if Conversations with God or Neil Donald Walsh turns into the latest fad. That would defeat the purpose of everything I've tried to do. On the other hand, if when book 3 is finished, and by the way, the concepts I just described to you, the circle and so forth, all of those visual constructions are part of book 3. Book 3 deals with the larger cosmology of all of it. And if at the end of book 3, it's clear to me that another book or more material or the dialogue is continuing and more material is coming, then I'm not obviously going to turn away from that. I've announced and declared myself to be a willing messenger of the grandest truth that I am capable of accessing, announcing to the world as I do so that I freely admit the filtering system which is in place in my own mind through which I seek to bring these revelations. And I'm aware that there's a filtering system there. So I don't claim, nor do I represent myself as infallible, nor do I claim infallibility. But I think that the material speaks for itself in terms of its clarity, in terms of the depth of its insights, and in terms of the eternality of its wisdom. This book contains eternal wisdom, and so do all three books. Will there be a book four or a book five? Well, no, there will not, unless there are.
There are two other books that come through in a similar way as the Conversations with God. One is the Urantia book, and another is A Course in Miracles.
Yes, I've been told by many people that Conversations with God is A Course in Miracles made accessible. That is to say, you can read it more than one paragraph at a time without getting lost in the circular construction. I thought that A Course in Miracles was an extraordinary document, but very difficult to plow through for large numbers of people because of the circular constructions and because of the way it was simply put together. To some degree, the same is true of the Urantia material, with which I have become familiar. But Conversations with God, I believe, and again, I don't say this from any standpoint of ego, because I was simply not involved in it except as a scribe. But as the scribe of that material, I can say that Conversations with God, I believe, is the first book to use such extraordinarily accessible language, such easy-to-understand constructions, and such totally visible wisdoms that even the most uninitiated among us can pick up that book and say, whew, I got it. I got it. It's clear. Now I understand. And we're getting 200 and 300 letters a week at this point from people all over the world saying exactly that. The most delicious comment of all that I received in the past year about this extraordinary material. Thank you, one lady said to me, for introducing me to a God I can fall in love with.